It's actually very flattering that I've been asked to MC this particular event, as I have been for years a big fan of Michel Chossadovsky. He is a PhD and educator and professor of economics at the University of Ottawa, and he's also the director for the Center of Research on Globalization. He is the author of several works, including Globalization on Poverty, The Globalization of Poverty and America's War on Terrorism. Michel has written numerous articles on the economics and politics of international crises and war from a geopolitical perspective. He has written and lectured extensively on the situation in the Middle East and in Central Asia. His research interests include economics of globalization, economic development, and international financial institutions. So, please join me in welcoming Michel Chossadovsky.
Krishna, I'm absolutely delighted to be in Manitoba. And since I've arrived here, it's been a whole series of activities, and this is certainly, I think, the climax of the anti-war process in Winnipeg. I would like to start with something a little bit different. I wanted to introduce you. We're always told that we should be balanced in our assessments of geopolitics and US foreign policy. So I thought, to give credibility to George W. Bush, we will give him the floor for a few minutes in a small video clip. And this is his presidential address, which has been subjected to a few little modifications, but otherwise, some people might have seen it. Otherwise, it's very educational, and it will say more than what I can say in the next hour. So please welcome George W. Bush. Ooh.
Vice President Cheney, members of Congress, distinguished citizens and fellow citizens. Every year, by law and by custom, we meet here to threaten the world. The American flag stands for corporate scandals, recession, stock market declines, blackmail, terror, burning with hot irons, dripping acid on the skin, mutilation with electric drills, cutting out tongues, and rape. Our first goal is to show utter contempt for the environment. I have sent you a comprehensive energy plan to devastate communities, kill wildlife, and burn away millions of acres of treasured forests. This government is taking unprecedented measures to protect our people and defend our homeland. And this year, for the first time, we must offer every child in America 3 nuclear missiles. To date, we have arrested or otherwise dealt with 400 billion key commanders of Al-Qaeda, which is enlisting tens of thousands of new volunteers across America. One by one, the terrorists are learning we are building a culture to encourage international terrorism. Almost 3 months ago, the United Nations Security Council gave Saddam Hussein his final chance to disarm. The United States will ask the UN Security Council to convene on February the 5th to consider the facts of Iraq's ongoing defiance of the world. Secretary of State Powell will plant information to incite fear about Iraq's links to terrorist groups. And tonight I have a message for the people of Iraq. Go home and die. Trusting in the sanity and restraint of the United States is not a strategy, and it is not an option.
I think certainly trusting in the sanity and restraint of either the Bush administration or the Harper government is not an option. We are gathered with a view to demanding the withdrawal of Canadian troops from Afghanistan. A debate has been launched across the land, from coast to coast. It has also incited some discussion within the political spheres in the Canadian Parliament. But I think what has not been raised are the reasons behind this war in Afghanistan. And I think to examine that, we have to go back to the events of September 11, 2001. Why is that? Because on September 11, in fact, in the afternoon of September 11, a war cabinet was formed immediately. And this was true, in fact, at 11 o'clock in the morning, the Bush administration had already stated, and the media had printed the first reports, that Al-Qaeda was behind the attacks and the Taliban was supporting Al-Qaeda, and that the whole operation had been sponsored by the Afghani Taliban administration. No police investigation at the time had been conducted. The decision to go to war against Afghanistan was taken late at night on the 11th of September in a war cabinet which was constituted on the spur of the moment. And then on the 12th of September it was announced. In the meantime, NATO invoked its Article 21, which stipulates that an attack against one member is an attack against all members of NATO. And the attack on the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, was viewed at the time as an act of military aggression by Afghanistan, in a sense, by the Taliban, who allegedly were harboring Al-Qaeda, directed against the United States of America. Now, there was absolutely no evidence of, at that juncture, and to this date there's no evidence, that Al-Qaeda was behind those attacks, and there was even less evidence, of course, that the Taliban had anything to do with it. I don't want to get into a complex debate on 9/11 at this stage, but when NATO invoked Article 21, they generated an obvious series of lies and falsehoods, which A, presented 9/11 as an attack by a foreign country, which is obviously a fabrication, and secondly, assuming that this foreign country was supporting the terrorists, or the alleged terrorists. Now, the war on Afghanistan commenced barely 3 or 4 weeks late, on the 6th, 7th of October. The Taliban government was approached in bilateral negotiations through Pakistan, and they said that they would gladly hand over bin Laden to the U.S. administration if the U.S. administration would provide them with evidence that bin Laden and al-Qaeda were behind the attacks. That position of the Taliban government was made, I believe, in the third week in September, 1 or 2 weeks about after the attacks, and then it was made again. And the Bush administration said, we're not negotiating with the Taliban, and they refused to enter into any kind of negotiations for the surrender of bin Laden to the Bush administration. And so the attack on Afghanistan was implemented barely less than a month after 9/11. Nobody, as I recall, within representative organizations on the left as well, questioned the legitimacy of that war. Nobody questioned the justification for waging a war of aggression on a country of 25 million people, not far from the population of our own country. And nobody actually raised the issue that this war was a war in violation of international law, particularly Article 6 and 7 of the Nuremberg Charter. It's the crime against the peace. It's the supreme crime. And the pretext or justification for waging this war was fabricated. It was fabricated, and 9/11 gave the Bush administration and its allies, including Canada, the pretext of waging a war of aggression against a foreign country. And bear in mind another factor which is crucial in understanding these events. You don't prepare a war in 3 to 4 weeks of that size and magnitude. But nobody in our distinguished press galleries, military analysts, raised the issue that the war against Afghanistan had been in the pipeline. It had been prepared well before 9/11. Okay? I have been, in the last few years, reviewing military documents, and I can tell you the minimum period for preparing a war is 1 year. Okay? And in the case of the war which is now being announced, we'll discuss it, the war on Iran, we're talking about at least a year and a half, 2 years. Okay? That it's been in the pipeline of military planning, deployment, and so on. But if you have to deploy equipment to the Middle East or to the Arabian Sea and get the aircraft ready and so on, you don't do it on the spur of the moment. And that people should realize. You don't even organize a peace rally in 3 weeks, okay? Now, let alone organizing a major theater operation with the deployment of troops and aircrafts and so on. But nobody seemed to be bothered by that. The war on Afghanistan was decided before 9/11. The pretext for waging the war was 9/11, yet there was absolutely no evidence to this date that either al-Qaeda or the Taliban had anything to do with it. In fact, if you go to the FBI website and you have a look, and they say bin Laden is wanted for his role in the 1998 embassy bombings, African embassy bombings. The website was updated in November 2001, and more recently the FBI has been confronted and say, why did you not indicate on your website that bin Laden is responsible for the attacks on the World Trade Center? And the answer came from an authoritative FBI source: we didn't have enough information to make that statement, and there's been no indictment against him. And our procedure as a police, a bona fide investigative police force, is to function on the basis of a judicial as well as an investigative process. And that, incidentally, has never been conducted. Now, another piece of information, which I think is very important, and has to do with 9/11, because the war on terrorism is a whole series of fabrications. Behind the war on terrorism is a real war of conquest, which has a lot to do with oil and oil pipelines, which you'll be seeing on the map. But Donald Rumsfeld has repeatedly stated, you might have heard him, he said, "Bin Laden, we can't find him. It's like looking for a needle in a stack of hay. He must be hiding somewhere up in northern Pakistan or in the Torabora Mountains." But on the 10th of September, the day before the September 11 attacks, Bin Laden was in a Pakistani military hospital in Rawalpindi. Now, Rawalpindi is a military city. It's the headquarters of the Pakistani military and intelligence. It's swarming with US military advisors and so on. And there's no way that Bin Laden have got into a military hospital on the 10th and then released on the 11th or the 10th or in the evening or whatever, and without being unnoticed either by Pakistani counterparts, intelligence counterparts, the inter-services intelligence, all the U.S. Missions which are also collaborating with the Pakistani military. And this information on Bin Laden's whereabouts on the 10th of September is courtesy of CBS News, Dan Rather, reporting from Rawalpindi, Pakistan. They sent a team of people to the hospital, they conducted interviews, and they conducted this report. This piece of information is absolutely crucial because it demonstrates that the administration is lying. If they say they can't find Bin Laden when Bin Laden was in a Pakistani military hospital on the 10th of September, let alone him actually orchestrating the 9/11 attacks from his hospital bed. But bear in mind, that in itself is an important piece of information. So when we look at Afghanistan, we have a war which was declared on humanitarian grounds. And I mean, everybody was supporting it, the trade unions, I mean, even some progressive organizations. I won't mention them because I was blacklisted by these people for saying that this was an illegal war, okay? I had to say, no, the Americans were hurt and it's understandable and they're going after the bad guys and so on. Now, look at the map and then you'll understand why we're there, okay? And we have to understand a little bit of history there, going back to 79, which is the Soviet-Afghan War. Afghanistan, as you see here, is at the hub of the former Soviet Union, Iran, Pakistan, and it also borders on China's western frontier. It is a land bridge for pipeline corridors out of the Caspian Sea basin, particularly those of Turkmenistan. Okay? So that this route here is crucial. And Afghanistan has been on the geopolitical chessboard for more than a quarter of a century. The war was in fact triggered in 79 under the Carter administration. It is well documented that the Carter administration and subsequent U.S. administrations, in fact, supported the Mujahideen, in other words, the Islamic Brigades, and of course Al Qaeda, which was the outgrowth of that movement, And in fact, bin Laden was actually recruited by the United States to fight the Soviet-Afghan war. So that these paramilitary groups were trained in CIA training camps in Pakistan. The ISI, which is the Pakistani intelligence, was working as a go-between the CIA and the Islamic groups. The madrasas were set up. The Saudi Arabian foundations would fund it. And they would send in their missionaries, their Wahhabi missionaries, and so on and so forth. And ultimately, another very important thing happened in the early 80s was the development of the Golden Crescent drug trade, where Afghanistan became the largest supplier of heroin. That happened, it started in the early 80s. There was virtually no opium cultivation in Afghanistan. It was an agrarian economy, self-sufficient, and I should say secular, okay? If you go back to documents of the 70s, you'll realize it was a secular Muslim state. And in many regards, with women's rights were developed and so on. And how were those women's rights destroyed? Through the US supported and sponsored Islamic freedom fighters, which were brought to Afghanistan to fight the Soviet Union. Now, nobody denies, and that's important, if you ask people in the intelligence community to say, well, did you support Al-Qaeda? Did you support bin Laden? They said, yes, we certainly did. Of course, you won't hear that when you read it in the newspapers. They won't discuss it. But certainly, it's something which is acknowledged. He said, yes, we did. But he turned against us. But the fact that this outside enemy of America, which is to, and now you see that the aircraft carriers in the Persian Gulf, they're all there for the global war on terrorism. But it just so happens that the outside enemy was created by US intelligence. But there's also ample evidence to show that, in fact, these Islamic, quote unquote, Islamic terrorists are still supported, financed, directly or indirectly, by the United States, and in fact, the relationship never ceased in the post-Cold War era. The U.S. intelligence will say, yes, we supported them, but in the post-Cold War era, they turned against Uncle Sam, and they're now fighting us. Okay, they're no longer fighting the Soviets, and so again, that evidence is of course very important because in the anti-war movement. My experience is people will say, well, you know, I'm against war, but I really think the war on terrorism is a good cause, okay? As if you can actually make those statements. You can't. Because if you say you're in favor of the campaign against the terrorists, the bad guys, but you're against the Bush administration's war in the Middle East, you're essentially providing the justification for those wars. Because all the national security doctrines contain reference to the war on terrorism as a principal justification. Okay, certainly in the post-Cold War era, that is the bogeyman, that is the enemy, and that is the main justification for waging a war of conquest. Now let's look at the geopolitics of this region and the broader region. Because we're not dealing with a single war theater, we're dealing with several war theaters, and we're also dealing with a roadmap. From the point of view of the United States, this is a military roadmap. It's not a single war theater. It's a sequence of war theaters, and as I mentioned, Afghanistan is at the hub of the oil pipelines. If you look at this broader region here, extending from the tip of Saudi Arabia, up to the Caspian Sea Basin, what do you have? You have between 60 and 70%, depending on the way you estimate it, 60 and 70% of the global reserves of oil and natural gas. Now that just so happens to be about 30 to 40 times those of the United States of America. Okay? So, and you can imagine, just a country like Iraq has 10% of global oil and gas reserves, which is 5 times those of the United States of America, which is less than 2%. And the West as a whole, there's some problems with the tar sands in Alberta as far as estimations are concerned, but I'm using the more conventional estimate, which doesn't include that. But even if you include that, you're still dealing with Western countries as a whole have very minimal territorial control over oil and natural gas. And the fact of the matter is today, if you take this region, which is of course a strategic region, 60 to 70% of the oil and natural gas is in that region, and then you add Algeria, Egypt, Nigeria, Indonesia, the Sultanate of Brunei, Malaysia, I hope I've mentioned all of them, but all you have, and I've done the approximately the estimate, you arrive at about 80%. 80% of the global supplies of oil and natural gas are in Muslim lands. And that is the basis of the demonization of Muslims. If they had been Buddhists, we would be demonizing the Buddhists. And if they had been Catholics, we might be doing the same thing. The fact of the matter is that demonization, the identification of a fictitious enemy is there to galvanize public opinion in support of a military agenda which responds ultimately to strategic and economic objectives. And there's, under those conditions, there's no role for Canada in this particular venture.
Hear, hear.
But and of course, Canada also has oil interests in that area because their Canadian partnerships with Canadian oil companies and so on. And then there's also the integration of foreign policy of the two countries, not to mention deep integration and the integration of command structures and the military and so on. I should also mention that the participation of Canada in Afghanistan is but the tip of the iceberg, because Canada is also now in the Persian Gulf integrating Expeditionary Strike Group number 5, which is a major naval group of aircraft carriers, submarines, and so on. And so there is a Canadian ship, it is under US command, and of course Canada has been involved in Haiti. And we are in a sort of copy and paste mentality that if they have homeland security, we have to have homeland security. We might call it a slightly different name, but essentially Canada is replicating many features of the neoconservative agenda. And another dimension of this whole question is the integration of Canada into the framework of Northern Command. I don't want to get into that, it's a very lengthy and complex process. But in 2002, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld made the statement when Northern Command was established, allegedly for the defense of the homeland against bin Laden, okay, that it had to include an area which extends from the Caribbean basin up to the Canadian Arctic, and it would encompass the entire Canadian landmass, and it would allow for the deployment of Canadian troops anywhere in our provinces. That was a unilateral declaration. You can consult it. It was never commented in the Canadian media, and it was never discussed anywhere in any of our parliaments, either provincial or federal. I sent a short article to the Toronto Sun. They accepted it on 3 separate occasions, said, yes, we're going to publish it next week. It was never released, and it contained Rumsfeld's quote. The Canadian territory now with agreements reached between the two countries, in effect, US troops can deploy anywhere in Canada. And that's part of the, when I say that Afghanistan is the tip of the iceberg, or even the missile defense shield is also part of the, is the tip of the iceberg, is that if you have integrated command structures, you don't even have the choice of saying, yes, no, I want to do it, okay? The Pentagon will actually then be in charge of the North American forces, and Canadian command structures will be entirely integrated. I can tell you that that is already the case, because at the Colorado Air Force Base, which houses NORAD, which is a bilateral body, and essentially what the US wants is that NORAD is scrapped and that Canada joins Northern Command. So what they've done is they've created an interim body which is called the Binational Planning Group, and they all house in the same building, and they have the commanders of NORAD or the commanders of NORTHCOM and the Binational Planning Group, and they all have the same football team. And eventually when the Binational Planning Group is abolished, and it was slated to be abolished last spring, Canada will join Northern Command, and it may be announced on page 23 of the Winnipeg Free Press. We won't even know about it. Now, let me get into the broader Middle East war agenda. And we'll be looking at an important document, which is the project for the new American century. This document is a semi-official document of the Bush administration. It was published in September 2000. It essentially establishes the military doctrine and foreign policy directions. There have been subsequent documents which go, in fact, even further than this document, and are much more detailed, but I wanted to bring to your consideration the summary of this document, which is in one very neat text box. You know, people like to look at text boxes, and it summarizes very well what the Bush administration is up to, and the statements are very revealing, because there's nothing of a humanitarian mandate when you say that you have to wage multiple simultaneous theater wars. The first objective is defend the homeland, okay? And that really is Northern Command, but it's the militarization of North America, but it's also the enforcement of the Patriot Acts, of the Homeland Security State, and so on, and the defense of this homeland against so-called terrorists. So that you can see that the war on terrorism was even part of the agenda even before the instatement of the Bush administration. That document goes back to 2000. Now the next component is very revealing, because every single word in that second objective expresses something very clear. Wage successive simultaneous major theater wars indicates, first of all, that there's a global military agenda, that the United States wants to be present simultaneously in theater operations in different parts of the world. So they're not sequential, they're simultaneous. They're not sequential, they're simultaneous. They're major theater operations. When you talk about theater wars, you're talking about Iraq or Afghanistan, okay? So when the Bush administration states its intention to wage a long war, they're not kidding. They mean this is to be carried out, and we can see that unfolding in the Middle East. Although in the Middle East, the war theaters tend to be sequential rather than simultaneous. But they're also simultaneous. Now, the third objective, very important, the constabulary functions. Now, this is nothing to do with the Gendarmerie Royale, okay, with the Mounties, okay. These constabulary in military terms means global military policing, outside the framework of a theater war. Okay, so the theater wars are large deployments of military personnel and equipment, and the constabulary functions are more ad hoc interventions, which might be punitive bombings, the sending in the special forces, and non-theater military operations of different kinds. It might also include intelligence operations, although it doesn't specify. And the last objective, transform U.S. forces to exploit the revolution in military affairs. This is essentially translated into develop more sophisticated, advanced weapons, humanitarian weapons, of course, because when they're used by the United States, they're never weapons of mass destruction. So there's a new generation of weapons. It's called exotic weapons. I won't get into it, but it's you've seen some reports about some of the new weapons they're using in Lebanon and the Gaza Strip. But other types of very sophisticated weapons. Of course, it's the militarization of space, and in turn, it is the development of a new generation of nuclear weapons. Now, this new generation of nuclear weapons are what they call in-theater nuclear weapons. They call them mini-nukes, small nuclear bombs, or they also call them tactical nuclear weapons. Maybe we can have the image of a B-61. This is a B-61. It's called a tactical nuclear weapon. It is part of a new generation of nuclear weapons, of small nuclear bombs, which have an explosive capacity between one-third and six times a Hiroshima bomb. Now, just to put this in perspective, the bomb by the Koreans was less than 10% of a Hiroshima bomb. It was a 1 kiloton bomb. So you're talking about the smallest version of this is a 5 kiloton bomb, and these bombs now are slated to be used in the conventional war theater alongside other weapons, and they are cleared for use in the Middle East war theater. I'm not suggesting that they will be used, but what I'm suggesting is that in the course of the last few years, there's been a massive propaganda campaign instigated by the Pentagon to have this new generation of nuclear weapons to be reclassified, so to speak, as humanitarian bombs. Because they say they're bunker buster bombs, so they're said to explode underground, and you need to go underground to go and catch Bin Laden in his cave. So what they're saying is, we're going to use these bunker buster bombs of the nuclear version, because we have to make bigger holes in the ground, and according to scientific assessments, which have now been achieved through Pentagon analysis and so on, these bombs are, quote, harmless to the surrounding civilian population because the explosion is underground. Now, I actually checked to see how far underground, and it's approximately 20 feet, so about half the size of this room, half the height of this room. Now, the fact of the matter is that these tactical nuclear weapons are now cleared for use in a conventional war theater, and they also belong to what the United States call the preemptive nuclear war doctrine. That's another aspect of this, because since 2001 they've come up with a number of major policy documents. One was the Nuclear Posture Review, and then there was another document which points to a new doctrine of integrating conventional and nuclear weapons, integrating their use, integrating the command structures. And that, of course, is very serious because it means that there's no longer this tight separation between a conventional weapon and a nuclear weapon, and the nuclear weapons are no longer weapons of last resort as they were during the Cold War. What exists now is the integration of conventional and nuclear weapons under the same command structure. And then what happens is that the military doctrine actually presents you with the notion of what is called the military toolbox. Okay? Now, people who are involved in renovating their home, they'll have their toolbox. I'm sorry, I didn't bring one with me. But this is your toolbox, and in the toolbox, you've got a bunch of Kalashnikovs, nuclear weapons, missiles, bunker buster bombs, and so on. Of course, all harmless to civilians. And then there's a statement that says that ultimately you have a mix of capabilities. And then you have to a little bit maximize efficiency. It's a sort of a profit-oriented neoliberal thing of, you know, if it's more efficient to use a nuclear bomb, we'll use a nuclear bomb, and in terms of actual objectives and so on and so forth. Now, I'm not kidding. The fact is that this nuclear, this military toolbox is part of the new framework, and the boundaries between conventional weapons and nuclear weapons has been broken. And in turn, the military manuals have been revised, whereby these tactical nuclear weapons have now been redescribed as harmless to civilians and ready for use and cleared for use in the conventional war theater. Now, we now see, of course, an evolving Middle Eastern situation. We have essentially, at the moment, three or four active war theaters. I would say that we have Afghanistan, Iraq, Palestine, which is a long-standing situation, perhaps not quite comparable to the other two, and we have Lebanon. So I would say there are four war theaters at the moment. We know, and this is very important, we know that the United States has already threatened Iran and Syria. In fact, these threats have been repeated time and time again. We also know that Iran does not possess nuclear weapons capabilities. It has a nuclear energy program, and that is confirmed by the IAEA reports, and it does not constitute a threat to global security. But then on the other hand, if you look at, perhaps you can put the, go back, yeah, this is the, now if you look, and that's where you have a clear case of double standards. If you look at a number of non-nuclear states today, including Belgium, the Netherlands, Germany, Italy, and Turkey, five countries, officially non-nuclear states, they all have U.S.-produced tactical nuclear weapons in their military bases, both under national as well as NATO auspices, and they all pointed at Iran, okay? Perhaps they pointed at other places as well. Germany is a nuclear power in its own right, because it produces nuclear bombs for the French Navy in the context of a joint venture relationship with Aerospatiale Matra, which is the European Aerospace Defense System Corporation, EADES, which is really the core of the Franco-German military industrial complex. But it officially, obviously, not a nuclear state, but it produces for the French Navy. And of course, we have Israel, which has has now, in recent weeks, has actually taken its nuclear missiles out of the silos, and they're pointing them at Iran. Okay, in turn, more than a year ago, there was the issuance of what was called Presidential Directive 35, which is entitled the Nuclear Authorization, the Nuclear Deployment Authorization. That's it. The Nuclear Deployment Authorization, which is a Presidential Directive number 35. And when I looked, I consulted this Nuclear Weapons Authorization, I came immediately to the conclusion it couldn't be the classical Cold War nuclear weapons, which are deployed all the time, okay? They're pointed at Russia and China and so on. And we know that because back in 2002, they actually announced the countries which were pointed at. But the Nuclear Weapons Authorization most probably pertains to the deployment of tactical nuclear weapons in the Middle East war theater, or for delivery in the Middle East war theater. And consequently, we are at a very, very dangerous crossroads. As far as the war on Iran and Syria are concerned, in recent months, pursuant to the threats by the Bush administration, there have been war games in all major regions of Iran. They started in late August and they extended into early September. But these war games were conducted precisely in response to US threats. But not only that, and that just shows how dangerous this situation really is. There have been war games by a number of allies of Iran, or unofficial allies of Iran, namely Russia, China, together with several of the former Soviet republics, which are members of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the SCO. And then there were other exercises conducted under the treaty which links Russia to a number of former Soviet republics, including Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan. And those war games have been held in the last 2 or 3 months, starting in August again. And the last set of war games were conducted by Russia on its entire territory, extending from the Valley of the Volga to Alaska. So you can imagine the territorial expanse. It's almost like coast to coast in Canada. Okay, from the European part of Russia right up to Alaska, to the Bering Straits. And it was reported in the Canadian press that NORAD fighter planes intercepted the Russian planes, but they said, well, we knew that they were conducting war games, but we just wanted to know that we were there, okay? So it was an insinuation, etc. It said, you know, you guys stay, don't cross the, you know, the into Canadian territory or whatever, or American territory or airspace. But what I'm suggesting is that there's an extremely tense situation when countries enter into war games. Now, as far as deployment of military hardware in anticipation of a war on Iran, that is already in the advanced stage. And in fact, I could say that even in June of last year, they were in an advanced state of readiness. The advanced state of readiness is very different to the logic of the Iraq campaign, because as you recall, when Iraq was invaded, there was a lot of opposition by some main allies and NATO members, including France and Germany at the time. But today, everybody seems in agreement. Everybody is in agreement. Jacques Chirac has even endorsed the preemptive nuclear war doctrine. I have his statement somewhere. Germany has endorsed the American stance on Iran, and NATO has signed two agreements with Israel, military cooperation agreements, one of which was signed on the 16th of October, and there was an earlier one which was signed back in 2005, which essentially establishes a framework even for joint military exercises, cooperation, sharing of intelligence, and so on. Israel and Turkey have a long-standing military alliance. Now, it just so happens that the deployments in there are two areas of deployment today. The first one is under the disguise of peacekeeping. It's in the Eastern Mediterranean. And people have said, oh, well, no, it's really on the war on terrorism, etc., that we're there, and we're there in a peacekeeping capacity between Israel and Lebanon. But anybody who has some understanding of military alliances knows that that's absolutely it's impossible, because, first of all, Turkey has this is so closely allied with Israel that they cannot play a neutral role. And all the NATO countries are bound by agreements that they've reached with Israel. Israel is, in effect, an unofficial member of NATO. And so what you have today is an unfolding military alliance, very different to what existed in 2003, where you have the United States, Britain is there, of course, Tony Blair is there, so Britain, the United States, all of NATO, which includes Canada, and Israel. And if Israel is involved in any way in the campaign against Iran, you can well imagine that we're no longer talking about distinct war theaters. This whole region, can you go back to the map? Yeah. Now, this whole region, from the Eastern Mediterranean, to the Chinese border, is going to erupt, and the whole thing is going to escalate. And so, if Iran or Syria are attacked again, then there's going to be an integration of these war theaters. And again, we're dealing, of course, Iran is a country which has a population of 60 million people. It's double the population of Canada. And it also has capabilities to defend itself. And so today we have a concentration of naval power in the Eastern Mediterranean. It's under German command. The French on the ground in southern Lebanon. Their mandate is essentially anti-terrorism, the war on terrorism, the actual mandate, because they have to apparently guard against the infiltration of Hezbollah, of weapons for Hezbollah. Now, if you look at the other area, which is the area of the Persian Gulf and the Arabian Sea, there is at present a massive deployment of naval power. Okay, apart from the fact that there's deployment of air power as well out of U.S. military bases in Diego Garcia, and also from the various bases which are in Western Europe. Okay, and on the 31st of October, in 3 days, the United States naval authorities in the Persian Gulf will be initiating war games right off the Iranian coastline, where they will be intercepting, this is the irony of this, they will be intercepting vessels entering the Persian Gulf and watching that no weapons of mass destruction actually are coming in. Okay, so this is an act of provocation, because in fact these destroyers and aircraft carriers, obviously what they have on board are weapons of mass destruction. Okay, but the fact that they enter into the Persian Gulf is not an issue. But any kind, so there's there there is always the possibility of an incident which could then either be used politically for George Bush's, for the midterm elections in the United States, or it could again be the pretext for wider war. We've seen that kind of occurrence going back to the Vietnam War when the Gulf of Tonkin incident then led, provided the Johnson administration with the pretext to actually wage war on North Korea. Now, it's very disturbing, again, that there's massive deployment of military power in these two theaters, and at the same time that the Bush administration has said we will use nuclear weapons in the conventional war theater because they're safe for civilians, and they mean Iran, and at the same time that our newspapers are not even mentioning the dangers of a broader Middle East war, or if they're mentioning it, they're providing, in a sense, an apology for punitive bombings which would be directed against Iran or Syria, which would then unleash a war at the level of the entire region. And I don't think it's appropriate to make predictions at this stage of what will happen, because we are here essentially to prevent this from happening. But on the other hand, when war plans are made in such a detailed fashion, and they are known, and they are documented, and that they involve nuclear weapons, legitimately, with a new legitimacy on their use, we have to make this information available, and we have to spread the word, network across the land, and reverse the tide. Because I think this is the most serious crisis in modern history. It's a military adventure which threatens the future of humanity. It has its own logic to it, and it's based on a consensus, and even the objectives which underlie it are not always clear. And I'll complete my presentation on that note. It is absolutely, you don't disarm a military agenda through anti-war sentiment. You disarm a military agenda by targeting the main political and military actors and their legitimacy. You also disarm a military agenda by revealing the falsehoods behind the justifications for waging war. And that's why I say the war on terrorism is ultimately the big stumbling block. 9/11 is very important, because without 9/11, they don't have a leg to stand on. They always talk about 9/11 and they're under attack, and that this is this is all a war of self-defense to make the world safer, okay, with nuclear weapons. And so, ultimately, we have to disarm the lies and falsehoods behind the war on terrorism, and we have to reveal the falsehoods behind 9/11. That's absolutely essential. When that happens, the whole ideological construct, which is behind the national security doctrine, collapses like a deck of cards, and we are in a much better position to sensitize our fellow citizens to the dangers of real war, which are a war of conquest and not a clash of civilizations or a war of religion or a war to make the world safer. And that is, I think, what we have to do in the weeks and months ahead. And I'm sure in the course of the discussion we should discuss ways in which our actions can be more effective. Thank you very much. Thank you.